The Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Got Ellen Brown on today. Ellen wrote Web of Debt, of course, on the banking system, the corrupted Wall Street controlled banking system. How we can get the power money back in our hands. Wall Street stole it. Ellen's book is an extraordinary tour de force. It explains what they did and what we can do to beat them at their own dirty game. And Ellen heads the Public Banking Institute. She's got a new book coming out on public banking one of these days. I'm eagerly looking forward to it. I mean, she better get it out soon or she'll need another book to replace it. Ellen, let me start off the program with a question today to my listeners, of course. Anybody know who Beppe Grillo is? Beppe Grillo? No, he didn't replace Bin Laden on America's Most Wanted list. Well, hold on a minute. Maybe he should, because he's a lot more dangerous than Bin Laden ever was. Well, Bin Laden was a covert CIA asset in Afghanistan. He helped the CIA and Washington beat the Ruskies in Afghanistan. He was an ally, and he hasn't been around since December 2001. Nobody killed him a couple of years ago. Obama didn't kill him. He died. He died a natural death. The New York Times reported it. Fox News reported it. Can you imagine that? And then they put it down the memory hole, so they come up with a concocted news story. Anyway, Grillo is a lot more dangerous than Bin Laden ever was. He's got some crazy ideas. Crazy ideas. Did you know the way the banking system, all the corporate-run power structures run, it's all corrupt and rotten in harms countries and harms people? I mean, imagine a guy running for political office with thoughts like these. He's not even a politician. He's a comedian. I never heard of him before. Well, he didn't win the election. This was in Italy, of course. I guess once in a while an Italian wins an election, but they often have coalition governments. Lots of countries end up with coalition governments. Israel never once in its history had a single party win an election. Every single governing party in Israel was a coalition government, And for weeks they've been trying to put together a new one after the January 22nd election. Anyway, that's another story. Grillo came in, I believe he came in third, but he got something like 25, 6 or 7% of the vote. Who ever heard of a guy nobody ever heard of except on late night television? I don't know where he is in Italy. He comes on, he's a comedian. I guess he performs publicly. I guess he comes on television. And aside from that, nobody ever associated him with politics, but he decided to run. He did very well. Whether he will follow through on the stuff that he talks about, who knows? Ellen and I exchanged a couple of emails this morning. I don't often see somebody follow through on their rhetoric. You know, when they're campaigning, you hear all kinds of bold promises. Well, I've said so many times, it's not a fair analogy, but I'll say it anyway. I've said so many times, Ellen, that every major promise Obama made, every single one from A to Z, he broke them. He broke them. Not a single exception. Well, of course, he was part of the power structure. Grillo is a comedian. So, Ellen, I hope I'm going to be wrong. I hope Grillo will be more than the exception that proves the rule. I hope he will be the example that says, if a non-politician gets into a major race and does well and has a chance to follow through on the promises he made or the ones he suggested, then the odds favor it really happening. And I really hope that's the case. Anyway, you've got an article you haven't put out yet. You sent it to me shortly before airtime. I took a flashbang glance at it, but I'll let you talk about it.
Okay, well, what really interested me was that part of Grillo's platform is basically quantitative easing for the people or social credit, which hasn't really happened, although it's been promoted for 90 years by the social creditors, where you would actually give the people a dividend of 1,000 euros a month. Well, his three platforms, or the three positive things he wanted to do, he's opposed to everything. You know, it's the party of fuck off, basically. That was what his symbol was. He had this National V Day, which was the V stood for something in Italian that basically meant fuck off. So he's against everything. They're against the existing political system. They're against the euro and every sort of treaty, NATO, et cetera, that Italy has entered into, which sounds very negative. But and it was said that, you know, you can't build a platform on negativity, but he actually has a very positive platform that I think is the right answer. I think it would work. So the three things in his platform were that, first of all, you would walk away from the debt. This, of course, has been done very effectively by Iceland, Argentina, Ecuador, Russia, and other countries. When you have a debt, as Grillo himself says, the debt is not because the government has been overspending. In fact, they spend within their budget. What the huge debt is from is the interest payments. And the interest payments are the result of the system in which speculators can go in there and the rating agencies, et cetera, can drive the price, the interest rates sky high, so that they're paying a lot more in interest than they owe on the debt itself. Now, if they were to, so he's proposing that they may have to go back to the lira and get rid of the euro, reject the euro system and go back to their own national currency and have their own. So a third platform was a nationalized bank that would nationalize the bank and then use it to issue basically social credit, issue the credit of the country, not backed by borrowings from private banks or from anybody, just government credit issued to get money into the pockets of the people so that they can get out there and go shopping and buy the products that are sitting there on the shelves with no takers, and therefore the economy is stalled. So that's how you actually get an economy going. The theory of C.H. Douglas, I mean, we all know that there's a horrible maldistribution of income and money, but the chances of getting it away from the rich are not real good. In fact, Thomas Paine had it in one of his books that we should have a social, or like a social dividend, or give a living wage, to enough money for people to live on, to everybody, basically social security all through your life. But I'm sure the reason that never got passed was that it would entail, his theory was, you had to redistribute. You had to take it from the rich and give it to the poor. But the way C.H. Douglas approached it, he was just approaching it as an engineer, as a mathematical problem. And he said the problem is there's simply not enough money out there, that all the money that people have to spend comes through their wages, and wages is a part of the price that's set by the producer. But besides wages, there are all these other costs, and probably the biggest one is interest. Margaret Kennedy says that interest composes 40% of everything we buy. So you have all these other costs, plus the fact that people don't spend all their wages. They like to save, so they save it in money-making money things. In other words, things where they expect more money back than they put out there. They're not spending it. They're actually lending it and expecting it back plus interest or plus profits or dividends or whatever. So you have all these reasons why there is not enough money to buy our own GDP in the system. And the solution to that, according to Douglas, was to just issue it. Basically, you're giving people a dividend for the privilege, or because they were privileged to be born in the 21st century, or, you know, for Douglas, it was the 20th century, at a time when robots and computers are doing half the work. So we should be getting a dividend. We should be getting the profits from that, or sharing the profits, or basically getting the money that the robots would have gotten, in order to get out there and buy our own products.
Well,
so
Ellen,
it's a great system.
You have written it, and I've certainly cited you and quoted you, and you have two articles earlier in February, and they both pretty well spell out the solutions to fixing the mess that we're in. I mean, either Congress and or the Fed I prefer Congress because that you know, put money power back in public hands. I don't like the idea of private bankers controlling the money supply. But the Fed, you know, Wall Street could do it as well. You know, if you put QE into the economy instead of into their own pockets, then people. You could create economic prosperity, if growth. If you create growth, jobs will follow. Jobs produce money. Money puts it in people's pockets. When they have it there, they spend. They may save some, and they do save some, but they also spend it, and that stimulates the economy, creates more jobs. It's a virtuous circle instead of a vicious one. And the better way is to put money power back into public hands, and let the Treasury. Let the Congress create money and put it into the economy. And that would accomplish the same thing. But when you give it to bankers that stuff it in their pockets and pay themselves big salaries and bonuses and use it to buy out competitors or to speculate and stash it in overseas tax havens, that kind of stuff, how do you grow the economy when you do that? Well, you know, I mean, their bottom lines are doing just fine, thank you very much, but the economy isn't. So that's the system we have now. That's the one we have to change. My concern about Grillo, Ellen, the single biggest disappointment for me goes back to the 1990s. Was it 94? I forget the year. I'd have to look it up and check. But I've certainly written about it before. Nelson Mandela in South Africa. Mandela spent 25 years in prison fighting apartheid, and he came out. And he ended up becoming president of South Africa. And what did he do? He followed the same damn policies that the previous government followed. And John Pilger wrote about him. He interviewed him. He wrote about him in his most recent book, which was some years ago, Freedom Next Time. I wrote about his book. And he just put it to Mandela point blank. You fought this system. And you spent a generation in prison because of what you did. And what are you saying now? And Mandela was very blunt to his face, and his statement was something like, Thatcherism now, Thatcherism always. You know, Thatcherism, Reaganism, you know, hand it to the corporate elites and forget about the ordinary people. And that was the policies that he followed, just contradicting everything he stood for and said. So if Nelson Mandela sold out, you know, I scratch my head and I say, will Grillo be any different if he gets a chance? Well, I hope he will be. Mandela wasn't a politician. He was an activist. He supported change. But he ended up doing the wrong thing. I think when you get into this power structure, Ellen, you know, they can really put the screws on you, and I can just imagine what they did to Mandela. I mean, they threatened a currency war. I know that. They threatened to destroy South Africa's currency. They threatened all kinds of stuff. They probably threatened to throw him back in prison. So they put the screws on you, and they pressure you, and no matter what you believe in, if you go against the system, well, you'll end up like Jack Kennedy. They'll kill you if you try to do anything. So maybe Grillo will get the same message. That's what concerns me.
Yeah, well, first of all, he can't actually run for president, or he won't under his own system because he was convicted of manslaughter, and, you know, it was involuntary manslaughter in a car accident that actually killed three people.
Grillo was?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Well, of course, I mean, he won't become prime minister, but I guess that's the top post that he could hope for. He could be part of a government and have something to say about it, but he'd have a minority voice, not a majority voice.
What's cool about them is that they're insisting that they are not going to compromise. Like, they're not going to vote for any bills. That's part of their platform. They want all of the people that are, you know, their slate have all agreed that they won't vote for any bills that have other things in them that they don't agree with. In other words, if it's not part of their platform, there. So they're being very purist about it, and they have an awful lot of leverage. That the euro system obviously isn't working, and somebody's got to bring it down. And it seems to me they have a huge popular following. I mean, who's going to? There actually is a lot in common with his platform and the platform of the Italians and the Germans and the Japanese that got him into World War II. And I've certainly read a lot saying that it was because they bucked the international banking system that they got involved in. I mean, that they had to be suppressed, and they were suppressed. They had to be stopped, and they were stopped.
It is very scary, and I absolutely despise the euro. I've written a fair amount about it. How can the euro system help a group of 17 countries in the eurozone, and you're combining a juggernaut, an economic juggernaut like Germany, with a basket case like Greece? But even if Greece were not a basket case, it's a tiny country. You know, it's like merging a Delaware with the rest of the United States. It just doesn't make any sense. And you give up your monetary control, your fiscal control. You lose control of everything. You basically have to take orders from an external monetary force, the European Central Bank. I mean, it's absolutely crazy to have a system like this. Mm-hmm. The euro expert, God, what was his name? I forget his name. Oh, I wrote about him, but it's been a while. He's in my book, and I forgot his name.
I do that all the time.
Anyway, he said the euro system was dead as a doornail before it ever came into existence in the 1998, I guess it was. He wrote a book about it. He was the chief economic advisor to the whole shebang, and he exposed it in his book before the euro was born. And he said it simply cannot work. It'll end up dying of its own inability to function properly, and they fired him. And I once tried to read, he's a consultant now, a very highly paid consultant, and I tried to reach him through his company. That was some time ago. I don't think he likes to give free interviews on radio programs, Ellen. I think he gets about $100,000 a pop for showing up somewhere and giving a very detailed economic analysis. So to get him on my program for nothing, that would be quite a reach. If I think of his name, I'll mention it. But he's the guy who is supposed to be the euro expert, and the guy who supposedly knows more about the system than anybody else calls it an absolute fraudulent hoax, impossible to work. It's just a matter of time when the whole damn thing is going to come down, a house of cards. I think he's right. Look what's going on now, and the longer you keep this thing levitating, the worse it'll be when it finally does come down. But I think the end result is it's going to fall apart. It's going to crumble under its own weight. Countries need to have their own sovereignty, Ellen. I think you agree on that.
Yeah, well, and it was basically a test case for eliminating the power of governments to issue their own money or borrow from their own central banks. They had to borrow from the ECB, which is not their bank. It's not them. They're not part of, like you said, Delaware and is part of the U.S., but they're not part of a country that will serve their interests. It only serves their, I mean, it only takes without giving. So that system, I mean, the goal, it appears to me, is to eliminate all government-issued money and make all money be issued by banks privately, so that we all are dependent on this system of debt money, where it's always, more is always owed back than we get, which means it's this huge pyramid scheme, which is ultimately unsustainable, but they're always siphoning that extra interest into their own coffers, making them the control point, you know, and in control, making us the serfs and them the masters.
Oh, absolutely. And the man's name is Bernard Connolly. I just thought of it. I don't know where he is now, but I do know he's a very, very highly paid consultant. And I remember quoting somebody. It was a money manager, and I absolutely don't remember his name. But he had a session with Connolly at one time. And he said getting together with him for an hour is like spending a year at the Harvard Business School. The quote was something to that effect. It was really a very, very strong endorsement for Connolly and his brilliance and how well he understands the system. Oh, I'd love to get him on this program. Bernard, if you're listening by any chance, send me an email. We'll schedule a date and I'll get you on. But it's not rocket science, Ellen, and you know it, how to fix the terrible economic mess that we're in. But the people running the system don't want it to be fixed. They profit very, very nicely by the system that they have. They milk everything they can out of it. They harm so many people. They wreck economies. The system works just great for them, but it causes so much harm and human misery to so many others. The only way you'll stop these people is when finally it reaches the end of its rope and it just collapses under its own weight. And Bob Chapman used to come on this program program all the time. Sadly, he died almost a year ago. The last time he was on, I believe, was in April last year, and he wasn't himself, and I didn't learn until a month or so later that he was very, very ill. And I think it was either in May or June he passed away. It was a big loss, but he basically said the same thing. He's a former insider. He said the same thing, that this system absolutely is corroded at the roots, and it's going to come crashing down one of these days. The only thing nobody can tell is when it's going to happen, but he said in his mind, from everything he could determine, he said there was absolutely no question it would happen. It was just a matter of when, and his own prediction was sometime from the end of last year to 2017. That's quite a window, Ellen. But, Gina, we have to wait until 2017 to bring this son of a gun down. Other people think it might come down this
year. What would be nice would be to not have a major horrible catastrophe, but just let's say, for example, Grillo could actually pull that off, just like Iceland did. I mean, they didn't have a major revolution no blood in the street or anything. They just defied the bankers, said they weren't paying, and they went through a period of difficulty, and then they came out on top and doing much better than the other Euroland countries. Well, they're not a Euroland country, but anyway, and Argentina and Ecuador, et cetera. It's not necessarily blood in the streets. So if he could prove that model just on a small scale the size of Italy, it seems to me all the other Euro countries would follow suit. And then, you know, we just need one model somewhere.
Oh, we really
That's
do.
That's what I'm writing about. There's actually models everywhere of different ways of doing it that we never hear about it. That's why it's been so interesting writing this book, because, you know, I would just think, well, I wonder what happened in whatever, Brazil or Korea or something, and then you look, and it's so interesting, and you think, wow, I never learned that in school. Why did they not teach us that?
Well, they don't want you to know that stuff.
No.
The Argentina.
I mean, they're so far ahead of us, and we're just, we resist, you know. It's like, oh, like we compete, or we feel like we have to bring them down, but what about just looking at what they're doing, and maybe we should do that too. Maybe it's not a bad idea.
We really should. I wrote about Argentina a few times, and the thing about Argentina is they went through a couple of very bad years, and they came out soaring on the other end of it. For a year or two, it was the fastest growing economy in South America. I'm not sure how well it's doing now, but to go through such duress, such immense duress, and then become the fastest growing economy in the hemisphere. Well, the same thing could happen to any country that goes through the Euro system if they just pulled out. I mean, if Italy pulled out, I mean that would be like pulling the stopper out of your bathtub, Ellen. The whole damn Euro system might collapse. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
It should collapse. But the question is, how much damage will result? If there's a way to do it that's kind of gradual and clean.
That would be the best way to do it, absolutely, because it can be a very nasty situation. I mean, they said, well, if it came apart, Ellen, because Italy or another country, or maybe several other countries, decided what Argentina did, they will either pay the bankers so many cents on the dollar, take it or leave it, and if they leave it, well, that's just tough. And I forget what the Argentina percentage was. It might have been something like 25 cents on the dollar. I mean, it was a big chunk they wanted the bankers to eat, and most of them took the deal.
And they should. I mean, it's not like people feel like, or they feel like, well, a deal's a deal. It says here we're going to get paid X amount, and that's our right. But why do they get that extra percentage? Because they took the risk that maybe they won't get paid off.
Well, that's right.
Well, in this particular case, they're not going to get paid.
Not going to pay. If you or I bought stocks, bonds, or anything else, and we took, if we get a gain, well, we keep the gain. And if we get a loss, well, that's tough. It's our loss.
Mm-hmm.
You
yeah.
can't go to somebody and say, I want you to cover my loss. Ellen, unlike the big corporations, I was involved in small family business. We went through some very rocky times because we had a very cyclical business. Extremely cyclical. We literally got washed over a few times. We never went to the government for money. They'd have laughed at us if we even asked. I mean, if we were going under, we were going under, and there wasn't going to be a dime in government revenue to bail us out. But, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's the Wall Street banks or Chrysler or Lockheed before it became Lockheed Martin and other companies. When they get in trouble, if the government decides they want to help them because they feel they're important, they give them so many, whatever amount of money they think they need. They bail them out. They keep them going. What kind of a system is that? That is not the way the system should be, and that is not what the capitalist ideologues think the system should be. It should be free market means you're in it for better or for worse, but that's not the way our system works. They're in it for better, and we're in it for worse. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty rotten system.
Yeah. And it's definitely true for the homeowners that took the hit. I mean, the argument of the banks is, well, you gambled and lost. You know, you thought it was going to go up and it went down, so there you are. Now you can't pay. But why did the banks not gamble and lose as well? I mean, they should all, it was the bank's fault, actually, that the housing market crashed. They should be taking the hit along with the, at least along with the homeowners.
Oh, should they ever be taking the hit? Ellen, I want a lot more than the hit. I want them clobbered on the back of the head and get them out of their current pinstripes and put them in black and white style with no tie and one of those little black and white caps I think that some of them wear, at least in some old movies, and stick them behind bars. And I want them cracking rocks in winter cold and sweltering summer heat. That's what I want. The death penalty is too good for them. I want them behind bars. They deserve to be punished. They have caused more harm than when imperial wars are waged. The unbelievable poverty and deprivation that those bastards have caused, they deserve the harshest punishment. I want nothing less for them. That's my punishment for them. Will they get it? Nah, they'll just get another chunk of money whenever they ask. Well, they don't need to ask for it, Ellen. I mean, they own the bank that prints it. They just tell their lackey, this guy Bernanke, you know, print me up, you know, just put a couple of extra zeros behind the decimal point and just print me up whatever amount they want, and this is what they do, and this is the way the system is run. Well, that certainly is not what is called classic economics, not by a long shot. Classical economics.
Well, it does remind you a lot of the mafia. We all can see it with our eyes. We all know that it's totally corrupt. I mean, how can they bankrupt a company, for example, and walk away with billions in retirement or whatever, that, you know, I mean, they get such deals. How can that possibly be fair? But we can't do anything about it. We just sit and watch like you would watch the mafia.
Oh, absolutely. And nobody really knows for certain how much money they stole, how much money they got. I guess some of it was paid back. But who really knows? And the numbers that I've seen, I think an official number is something like $13 trillion. But some estimates run up to $23 trillion or higher. Nobody knows because nobody says. Some of the information gets forced out of the Fed. But I think the full scale of what these guys did, we just don't know. Anyway, let's take a short break. We'll come back and do some more banker bashing. Go, Bepi! Go, Bepi! Ellen, it really is astonishing what Grillo did, and I love to tell you. You have an article that's still a work in progress. Can I mention it, or you want me to say nothing?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, I think it's a marvelous title. I think you really nail it. QE for the people: Grillo's populist plan for Italy. And of course, the Fed has QE, but that QE goes to the bankers, the boss, Bernanke's boss. When the boss tells you it wants QE, you do what the boss tells you, or you get fired. And Grillo wants it for the people. And, I mean, it's astonishing. You quote The Guardian saying, his movement is now the biggest single party in the Chamber of Deputies, which makes him a kingmaker in a hung parliament. Oh, I hope that is right. I really hope that is right. I mean, it would be marvelous if somebody really, no matter who he was, no matter what his background was, whether he's a political prisoner, whether he's a comedian, whether he's anything, if somebody out of the blue really turned out to be the real thing,
that would be an inspiration for others to replicate him and want to do the same thing. It would be marvelous, Ellen. And I think his support would only grow if he really tried to do stuff that would help people. I mean, he got 8.7 million votes. My God, I mean, he could take that 25-odd%. And, I mean, there won't be more votes until another election. But there could be a groundswell of support for him. I mean, if the guy can just stay alive, I think that's his biggest problem. If he ever gets a chance to institute the stuff that apparently he believes in. I mean, you and I believe in this stuff. You know, I have to think that he believes in it too, even though they're going to really put the heat on him.
He writes well. I mean, he does seem to understand all the issues, at least what I've seen. He had a blog on the internet, and that's where he did all his promotion. I guess he was banned from TV because he was very controversial and, you know, bad language, etc. But it's like Jon Stewart or Max Kaiser. They can use humor to say things that they otherwise wouldn't be able to say, and everybody thinks, oh, well, it's just a comedian, you know. It's the place of the court jester who could criticize the king and get away with it because he was just joking. It was all just a joke. So that's why I read somewhere that he was quite surprised himself that it did so well. It wasn't his intent. His intent was to stir up a lot of controversy, but he did it in a really good way. You were mentioning about our quantitative easing. My previous article was on why it doesn't do what you would think it would do. I mean, people say, well, we've already tried quantitative easing and it doesn't work, and all it does is drive up gas prices. But it's not in fact, we're still in deflation, and people don't realize that because they look at gas and they look at the commodities, which is where all the hot money has fled now. That would be gas, food, and what's the other one? Like gold and silver, precious metals. But if you look at housing and labor, which are the two biggest components of the price structure, they are still way down. So actually, we're actually still in a period of deflation. There's not enough money out there competing for goods and services. So you need to add more money to the economy. And people say, well, we've already done that. We're on QE3 and it still hasn't worked. But they haven't done it. The money doesn't get into the economy. It only gets as far as the reserve accounts of banks because of this very strange system, money system we have, where there's like a two-tiered system. There's the money that the banks get to use, and then there's the money that we get to use. And the money we get to use is the bank-created debt. Our money is created on the books of banks whenever they make a loan, and it's called bank credit, basically, unless we're actually literally dealing with pennies and, you know, with coins and dollar bills, but that only composes 3% of the circulating money supply. So almost all of our money is this stuff that's on your balance sheet on the computer. It's all electronic money, and it's all created by banks. At interest, obviously. So they're the gatekeepers. They decide who gets it. They decide the interest rate, etc. But the money that the Fed deals in, the money that the Fed creates in quantitative easing, goes right to the reserve accounts of banks, and it just sits there. They can lend it to each other. That's what reserves are for. They're to clear check balances. And if you don't have enough in your reserve account, then you can borrow it from the other banks at the Fed funds rate, which is ridiculously cheap, 0.25%, or you can borrow from the money market, et cetera. And the money market was what froze and caused the collapse of 2008. So then what I looked at in this article was why the Japanese have been doing it that way for 20 years, and it hasn't worked, and they're still doing it. Why for 20 years were they doing the same thing when it didn't work? And the answer, according to Richard Werner, who is the man who invented the term quantitative easing, he's a British professor, and he was advising the Japanese in the 1990s. And what he told them to do was to issue credit into the real economy. Where they were in deflation, they needed more money out there, and they should issue the credit and get the economy going. But what they did is the same thing they're doing now, which is just an asset swap. In other words, the Federal Reserve issues the money and buys something off the asset side of the balance sheet of the banks. So the banks used to have whatever, a toxic mortgage-backed security, and now they have dollars, but the numbers haven't changed. They've just swapped an asset for dollars, but they've become more liquid because their mortgage-backed securities weren't liquid. So anyway, according to Werner, what went wrong here was that for decades, the Ministry of Finance, which is the government, and the Bank of Japan, which is the head of the central bank, you know, it's part of the central banking system and the head of the banking system, they have been in a battle for control over the economy. And the Bank of Japan didn't care if they brought down the economy or froze the economy. They won. They did ultimately win. They got control back from the Ministry of Finance. And but now we they have a new administration, Shinzo Abe, and he has threatened to take the central bank in a hostile takeover unless they come around to actually issuing money the way they should be and actually increasing, you know, reversing deflation and increasing the money that's out there.
Do you think he really will do that?
Well, it's a cool, you know, it's cool that somebody dares to say it. And apparently, I think I saw that he was replacing the head of the bank.
Oh, well, you know, I'm certain you're going to be following this, and if there's anything interesting to report, you will write an article about it. I sure will be looking for that. I mean, you would think, Ellen, after 20 years of dismal failure, the Japanese would be smart enough to realize we just are not doing it right. We need a new approach. I mean, how long does it take to realize you've completely botched the whole system? And it shows in the stock market over 20 years. It'll go up a lot, and it'll come crashing down. It'll go up a lot again, like a roller coaster, up and down, up and down, up and down for 20 years. And the Japanese stock market, listeners probably don't remember that the Japanese stock market, on the last trading day, I remember this, the last trading day of 1989, the day before New Year's, whatever day the Japanese market closed, but it was this last trading day, it closed just a smidgen below 39,000, I think it was, 39,000. Well, back in 2008 or 2009, the Nikkei, the main average, the Japanese Dow, hit a low of something like 7,000 and change. 7,000 and change from 39,000? I don't know what it is now. I think it's around 11,000. But 11,000 now, call it a fourth, roughly a fourth of what it was over 20 years ago. Doesn't that indicate that you're just not doing it right? Well, we'll see whether Abe can do. He was prime minister before. I guess he didn't do it right. Did he? I hope he learned from his mistakes.
I don't know. But according to Werner, it was actually the Bank of Japan that caused that whole collapse in 1989. First, they drove the market way up by insisting on easy credit. They forced the banks to push credit out there. And that, of course, drove up housing prices, just like they did in the U.S. And then it was the Bank for International Settlements, the Basel Committee, that changed the reserve requirement from 6% to 8%. And the Japanese banks were then the biggest banks in the world, the strongest banks, the biggest creditors in the world. And that broke the bank. I mean, they didn't have as much in the way of capital as other banks. And just that modest change caused a bunch of banks to go bankrupt, or allegedly go bankrupt. Actually, they were nationalized by the government, but very quietly.
They had at least two bubbles. They had a stock market bubble, and they sure as hell had a real estate bubble. And boy, did they have a pop with a loud bang.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still coming back. And I guess Japan did a lot of stuff like building bridges to nowhere. I don't know if they're still doing it. But you explained very well in Web of Debt, and I certainly quoted from you and I learned from you, Ellen, that you literally, if you put money directly into the economy, it simply does not matter how much you put in. If it's used to stimulate economic growth, if it's used for hanky-panky speculation, all the rest of the garbage, then you can run into an inflation problem. But if the money goes to generate economic growth, you can do it inflation-free. And you explained again in colonial America, for 25 years, the individual states had a system, roughly that. They put money into their economies. They grew without taxes. I guess there were tariffs, but without an income tax, inflation-free for 25 years. They controlled their own money. Well, my God, if the colonials could do it right, then why the devil can't we do it right today? Well, we can do it right. Lincoln did it right. The post-Civil War economy did it right. If it could be done right then, when people didn't know anything compared to what they claim they know now, we sure could do it now. We could have prosperity. It's not rocket science. It works. Ellen, if you and I ran the Treasury and the Fed, we could turn the whole damn system around, and I sure as hell am no expert on this stuff.
Yeah, no, I agree, but how do we get our people in there? That's the problem.
That's the problem.
I think we have an advantage now because of the Internet. They really can't keep us fooled so much longer. I read that about Grillo's, about Italy, that you can only fool the people so long, that it's for 10 years the euro has not worked. They're just going down, 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 and at some point they're just going to say this austerity doesn't work. We're walking away.
Well, this is what Gerald Celente says all the time. He sees a very bad ending to this, and it could be very, very violent. And it's true. And the Europeans have a lot more spunk than Americans. Americans have Occupy Wall Street, but it comes, it goes. There are small gatherings. There's nothing very major, but there are stories all the time about massive protests going on, mostly in Greece, in Spain, but they happen in other countries too, in Ireland, in Italy, in Portugal, in Britain. It goes on in Germany. Germany, the most prosperous of the European economies, even though it's a little bit shaky now. They had a down quarter at the end of 2012. But people have a lot more spirit, a lot more spunk. They see what's going on. They're being harmed tremendously, and they get out on the streets, and they're extremely active about it. And sooner or later, those street protests will get even bigger. And if nothing is done to create the misery that's being created, and the screws keep getting tightened, tighter and tighter and tighter, then you're going to see violence, and it could end up the way it's happened in history. There could be a revolution. And I say myself, and I really believe it, the only solution is a grassroots revolution. I want a nonviolent one. If we ever get to the violent stage, it could be very, very nasty, and who knows how that could turn out. But we absolutely need a grassroots revolution to change a system that is so corrupted, so dysfunctional, so impossible to fix, that if people don't do it on their own, it won't happen unless or until the whole thing just absolutely corrodes and it tumbles under its own weight. Sooner or later that will happen, but just imagine the misery that could come with it, the extreme poverty. I mean, there could really be some terrible, terrible hard times for so many people. I prefer a nonviolent revolution to change it sooner. I encourage people to get involved in something like this. We've done it in America before. We had a labor revolution. We had a civil rights revolution. We had an anti-slavery revolution. Why can't we have an economic equity revolution? We could if enough people went out and did it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think the first thing is you have to understand the banking system. It all seems so confusing to people, and they think, well, this, you know, I don't understand, I don't know which side to be on, and then they go back to watching their movies or whatever.
Well, they sure could get somebody to join their ranks who did understand the system. Ellen, are you available?
I'm available.
Well, maybe you can become the Beppe of America.
Yeah,
I sure will vote for you. I can guarantee you that. I'll even be your campaign manager.
Oh, cool. Well, it is kind of daunting, but it just seems like we there's not much we can do but just keep pushing. And things do seem to be changing. And I mean, the reason I keep writing is I always kind of fantasize that somebody's actually listening. I mean, I get all this feedback, and I think, oh, somebody's actually listening to me.
So. Well, I think people are listening. We need to get more people listening. And I say it often in this program, the people who tune into this program, we're preaching to the choir. So you all have an obligation. You need to spread the word to others. Most people don't understand. Most people who do don't do anything about it. The people who do understand have to do something. They have to tell others. If that happens, and it happens with enough impetus and force, and resolve, then big things can happen. Once in a while I discover there's only one website they post my articles, that keeps a running tabulation of how many people actually read them. I have no idea who reads my articles and what numbers, but there is an article that I wrote that is a smidgen below 40,000 readers to an article. That has to be by far my most read, well-read article, but I'm not sure because I
don't
know.
What's it in?
It was an article I wrote, an open letter to New York Times editors, of all things. It wasn't about the state of the economy. It wasn't about war and peace. But a lot of that stuff was in the article. I wrote an open letter to New York Times editors. I put plenty in it, and it absolutely caught fire on one website. It astounded me. And it bothered me more that some websites that should have known better didn't post it, and yet this one that did, it was posted. I don't think it's been 2 months, but I think it may be getting close to 2 months ago, and in that time, 40,000 readers, and it doesn't stop. I mean, it's not visible anymore. The article isn't visible. People, I don't know where people find it now. I mean, even to find it on this website, you have to go into a section that talks about the all-time readership articles, because it's not listed in another section that they have openly on their home page. So you have to make it a point to go into this all-time section and check what are the most popular articles. Well, I will never be the all-timer on this website, because there was an article written about Che Guevara. Over 300,000 readers.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But it shows what can happen, mm-hmm, when you really strike the right nerve and you get people interested. And whether it's about Che or the New York Times or the economic situation, war and peace, name anything. I mean, 9/11, another very, very major topic. You can get extraordinary numbers of people to want to read this stuff. And then the people who understand it, again, I say, you need to tell others, because we're the people who are being screwed. We're the only ones who can change things. And again, I say it, change only comes at the grassroots. It never comes any other way. It's never come in human history any other way. If we're going to fix the system, if the system is going to be fixed, we're the ones that have to fix it. No question.
Yeah.
Your turn.
I had an article in Seeking Alpha that got 400 comments, and they're almost all negative. You know, these are investor types that are more the, but I think that's cool. And then my last article there got 200 comments, also largely negative, but it's cool to generate that much conversation. I mean, they just keep talking. I don't even join in. They just talk to each other.
this is on Zero Hedge?
Seeking Alpha.
Oh, Seeking
so
Alpha.
It's an investor website, so it's like Gold Bugs and libertarians.
The investors don't like the advice that you're giving is bad for investments.
They think quantitative easing is, that government printing money is outrageous and inflationary and so forth. But then there are always people that defend on the other side. So anyway, I figure, I'm generating interest. They're thinking about it because they bother to jump in.
Oh, absolutely. I get very few negative comments. I get some, but very few. The comments I make are overwhelmingly positive. But there's a bad side to that as well as a good side, Ellen, because it says that I'm preaching to the choir. I mean, it's fun to preach to the choir, but I want to preach to people who don't understand this stuff. Well, you got to really hammer them and hammer them and hammer them. And once in a while, I'll get an email from somebody like that, and I know they're on the other side of what I stand for, and they'll take great issue with me. Great issue. Well, you know, I keep going and I keep going, and I'll answer them. I'll make a comment that I feel is important, but they'll still stick to what they want. If you're going up against investors, Ellen, you really have a tough road to hoe. I mean, they want to make money. They don't care what's good or bad. The only thing that's good is what makes the money. So that's a tough thing to go up against.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. And I get lots of comments to my email, which are positive, which is a good thing, I think, about doing things on the internet, because the first books I wrote, you know, you had to go to these book signings and you would sit there and nobody came and nobody really cared, or, you know, in other words, you kind of had to actively face people. It's kind of like, do you want to buy my book? And no, not really. You know, so you get rejection. But on the internet, you get all the positives, which is very stimulating. I mean, it keeps me going.
I've never had a book signing ceremony, but if somebody wanted to set one up for me, I'd go through it. I mean, the idea of sitting there for hour after hour, I mean, even if I sold books, I would say, oh, my God, it's taking time away from my writing. I want to write another book.
Yeah.
But Weber did. It's done very well. I don't keep track of how mine are doing. My newest one has only been out since the end of the year. So it was in sometime in December. I forget the date. Banker occupation. So it's been two months old, roughly 2 months, a little over 2 months old. And the other one was a year before. I had a lot of interviews on the other one. I've had a few on banker occupation, and I have another interview on it Monday. While we've been on, Ellen, I got an email from the host of the program that he'll call me tomorrow morning and we'll talk about my book. Well, that's great. I love that. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could be on a major source that would really give us a great deal of play? The junk that ends up on the New York Times bestseller list, I mean, that's just junk that nobody should throw their money away on. But if something like we wrote ended up on a table like that and got promotion from the New York Times, my God, would sell thousands and thousands of copies. And the idea for me, well, it's nice to make a few bucks, but to be able to spread the word well to people who need to know important truths, for me, that would be the most important thing. I would truly, truly love to have a chance to do that. But it's pretty tough. I mean, the New York Times just wouldn't pay us the time of day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we live in exciting times. Yet you said I better get this book out there because I'll have to write a whole new book. But that is the reason I don't have it out there yet, is because things are changing so fast. And then I think, oh, well, I better update that, and I better update that. I mean, already what I've said is, like, obsolete. So I think maybe
terrible.
I'll just put in the preface something like that, you know, these things are true as of the date of the last thing I cite.
At some point, and I want to give you the last minute or two, I'll just make a fast comment. At some point, you know, you need to cut it off and say, that's it, we're going to press. And the next day something important would happen, and you pass the deadline, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
there was stuff in both my books that I wanted to make some changes, but I got the cutoff date, and sorry, too late. You can't get it in. You go with what you have. That's the problem, the difference between writing an article and writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, once the article goes out, well, when an article goes out, you can write a follow-up article. Anyway, we've got a minute or so left, Ellen. Some final thoughts.
Well, I do want to plug we have a conference coming up with the Public Banking Institute. It's June 2nd to 4th in San Rafael, California. And our website is publicbankinginstitute.org. I'm really looking forward to it because I like to meet the people and we really get to talk about these things, not just, I get feedback and all that, so it's great.
That is marvelous, and I think a man by the name of Jim Hogue is going to be there. Is that right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
He's the one who'll be interviewing me tomorrow in my banker occupation book. He asked me if I was going to California. Well, I won't be there, Ellen. I won't be there in body, but I'll certainly be there in spirit. Ellen, I look forward to getting you back in a few weeks. It'll be wonderful to have you back. I got to cut it off. The music says I got to vamoose. It was another great hour, Ellen. All your articles are tremendous. Whenever you see an article by Ellen Brown or her book on public banking, you got to read the book. You got to read her articles. She does the best financial writing I know. Ellen, many, many thanks.
And thanks, Steve.
Join us again next Friday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, Saturdays and Sundays, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.